The following sermon audio is from Missio Dei Church, Cincinnati. More information about Missio Dei Church and our pursuit to be a gospel-centered, city-focused church community can be found at www.mdcincy.org.
I'm going to be in the book of James. I'm going to be in chapter 2. And here's how I want us to all kind of jump into this story. Some of you are going to relate to this. Some of you are going to be like, man, he's actually a lot older than I thought he was because he looks 15, right? He's got some gray hair sprouting, but I thought that was just some weird genetic disorder because he looks like a baby up there. But in the 1990s, as I was wrapping up my high school career, some of you guys were born in the 1990s, right? Some of our older folks are like, yeah, I was, you know, you're one of my kids, so don't tell me about being old. But anyway, 1990s, there was this like sneaky thing happening among folks that were making romantic comedies. They were trying to come up with subversive ways to draw people like myself, who is somewhat averse to sitting down and admitting that I enjoy a romantic comedy, right? And so one of these films is the film Jerry Maguire. Have you guys heard of it? Have you seen it? You guys enjoyed it? Yeah, okay. Well, I will admit, I actually did, but what kind of roped me in to the film was not that it was a romantic comedy. I actually felt a little bit deceived watching it and finding that out, because the premise, as I understood it, was that it was about this sports agent who had a professional athlete played by Cuba Gooding Jr., and it was about their relationship and their interplay. And I didn't realize it was about this guy's assistant who had a crush on him, and as time went on, he returned the crush, right? And then they completed one another somehow. Not sure how that works out exactly, but but there's this one scene in the film, and if you haven't seen it, what ends up happening is Jerry Maguire, who's played by Tom Cruise, he works for a sports agency as a player representative, an agent for the players. And he gets blindsided and he gets cut from his job, and he's trying to, as he's let go from his position, he's trying to retain as many athletes as he possibly can so that his whole career isn't completely sunk. And so he's making phone calls and he's got all kinds of people on the line, and he gets on the phone with the pro football player played by Cuba Gooding Jr., and this guy is keeping him on the line, and he's freaking out a little bit because he has to make other calls to get other athletes. But the football player is trying to slow him down, and he's trying to teach him that actions speak louder than words. And so he's intentionally keeping him on the phone and basically going over and over and over and saying, Jerry, I need you to do more for me. I need you to do more than just say things. I need you to do things for me. And then he has the line. He makes him scream to really drive the point home. Do you remember the line he makes him scream over? Show me the money. Yes. Show me the money. And he makes him scream and jump up and down, and he loses his mind, and he screams, show me the money. Now, that's relatable, because I think we've all been in situations where we look at people and we want to make them scream so that they understand you've got to do something and stop just talking, right? We want you to show us the money. Like, put your action, or put your words into action. And this is not something new. This was not invented in the 1990s with Jerry Maguire. It wasn't invented with your life. James, the apostle, the half-brother of Jesus, he's dealing with the same issue in the people of God who are scattered throughout the Middle East and scattered around the Roman world. And so he addresses them, and he's addressing a group of people that are very good and very gifted at confessing the faith, but not necessarily practicing it. And so what James is going to tell them, in a sense, is, hey, guys, show me the money. Show me the money. So let's look at it. Chapter 2, verse 14, and I'll read through the end of the chapter. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you the money. No, I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with the works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. This is the word of the Lord. Now may God abundantly bless our study of his word today. Here's what James is doing. He does three things with the text. I'm going to mention them now, go back, and we'll walk through it a little bit. But the first thing he does is he asks a question. Right? He's going to ask a question about this relationship with faith and action. And then what he's going to do is he's going to bring up a contention. Because you ask this question, he's going to make kind of a point, and then people are naturally, in their hearts, they're going to push back against it. And so there's going to be a contention. And so then he's going to respond to that contention. He's going to draw a conclusion. And he's basically just trying to make one simple point here. And so let's look at this a little more closely to really get at it. He asks the question. He repeats it twice. He asks the question, what good is it? Right? The people of God are supposed to be a people of good news. That's what the New Testament is all about. The word gospel, it literally means good news. And the people of God are supposed to be bearers of that good news. And so James is addressing a group of people that are scattered that claim to be people of good news. And so he asked them the question, hey, what good is it? What good is it if you say you have faith, but you don't do anything about it? How is that good? Right? And we're living in a culture where I think our culture is asking the same question to the church. They're saying, hey, what good is it that you say you believe all these things, but we don't ever see the fruit of it? What good is that? And he goes on, he asks it again. He says, does that faith, this faith that's just confessional, but it doesn't cause you to do anything or change anything about your life, does that have the power to preserve you? And it's an interesting word that he uses to talk about power. Like there's authority in power, but what he uses is where we get our root word for dynamite. Right, like an explosive power. Does that kind of faith have the power to preserve you, to save you, to sustain you, to grow you? And the obvious answer is no, it doesn't. Right? It's no good. That's the answer to his question. What profit is it? What good is it to merely say things to people without doing anything about meeting their needs? When you encounter people that are struggling to make ends meet, what good is it for you to just wish them well? James says, we've got to do something about this. We've got to be active. And then he recognizes some people they're going to start to make a contention. So verse 18 introduces that contention. All right? This is in the heart of his readers and a contention that most of us share. Now, before we can really dig into this, I want to point out something grammatically that can be difficult. If you have an older translation of the Bible, like maybe a King James version of the Bible, you'll notice this text, verse 18, it doesn't have any quotation marks, right? It just kind of reads. If you have a newer translation, they put the quote in quotation marks so that you understand who's speaking and when they're speaking. But in the original language, there are no quotation marks. And so it's left up to the translators to note where to put them. So if you're dealing with a very literal word-for-word translation, like the New American Standard Bible, you're going to read a longer quotation than what is included in the English Standard Version, which is the Bible that we tend to use here at Missio. And so the question is, well, where does this quote end? And there are a couple of options. The first option would be that it's longer than the first statement, right? And so the statement is made, someone will say, "You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." Now, the NAS just ends it there. I'm not sure why they picked that place to end it. It seems a little bit arbitrary, because if you follow the language, it continues with this "you" and "I" even into verse 19, right? And so where it ends gets a little bit confusing. So the first option is to just go on beyond the initial statement. And here's what we do know. We know that by verse 21, since everything changes in the grammar, we know that by verse 21, whoever's contending with the point that James has made, he's done talking, because everything starts to change grammatically there. But where does it end? Now, some would want to include the rest of verse 18. "You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." I don't think that's the best way to do it. Because what's happening is James has made a point. Faith without works is dead. Then the next verse is introduced as a contention. But, someone will say, right? You don't interject with a "but" if you're agreeing with what's being said, right? And so if you carry it out past that first initial phrase, whoever is contending is actually agreeing with the point that's being made. "Show me your faith by your works," or "show me your faith without your works. I'll show you my faith by my works." Normally, in arguments, we don't do that, right? Normally, in an argument, you don't say, hey, "I disagree," and then make the very point that you were disagreeing with. Now, I wrestled with whether or not I was going to share this, but I'm feeling a little frisky. I'm in a good mood. Let's see if I can bring it down a little bit, okay? I would contend, and most of you would, you know, you'd hear this, and you'd probably shudder a little bit and push back, but I would contend that the best, or at least the better, NFL football team in the state of Ohio is the Cincinnati Bengals, right? I shouldn't have warned him, right? I would contend. Now, we've got somebody that would say, "But I disagree." He's sitting in the back row, right? I would disagree. So then, if he's disagreeing, he wouldn't want to highlight the fact that the Bengals have more divisional wins than the Browns, that they actually have 2-0 AFC championships, right? Right? He wouldn't bring those facts up if he wanted to disagree with me strongly. That wouldn't happen. You don't say, "I disagree," and then prove the point, right? Because then you feel silly, even if you don't care about looking silly, right? I shouldn't have warned you. So, yeah, I know. I'll be gone. We'll edit it out of the recording, too, so I'll never have to hear it. So it would be unnatural to kind of throw out this corrective and then agree with the statement that's made. So what's likely happening, and I think the best way to understand this, best way to read it, is the way that ESV translates it. You put the quotes around the very first phrase, and then after that, James is addressing. He's countering the counterpoint. Does that make sense? So he makes the point, faith without works is dead. It's empty. It's worthless. Now, some of you are going to say, "Well, I have faith and you have works." And then James is going to immediately jump on that and correct it. And what he's doing is he's addressing the question that people have, which I think is how we operate. This worldview where we think we can separate the two, where we can say you can have faith or you can have works. That's what goes on in our hearts. Some people want to really highlight the faith that they have. Others of us want to, you know, we want to downplay the faith that we have. We want to upplay the works that we do. And James is saying, you can't do that. You show me your faith apart from your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. You can't just have this empty faith. You've got to have both together. And what he's not saying is you have to have works instead of faith. He's saying they go together. And that's the whole argument that he starts to make. And that's where he goes into the third part in the conclusion. He's going to conclude by showing examples of the faithful through the ages. They believed and they acted. They believed and they acted. And then he summarizes it with this last thing: as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. Faith is the body, works is the spirit. Works are what animate the faith. and demonstrate that it's living and alive. Now, I don't want to jump off this too quickly, because if you're familiar with the Bible, you might notice, this seems to contradict something that was brought up in one of Paul's letters to the Romans. Are we justified, and they use the same language, by works or by faith? So I want you to look at Romans chapter 3, verse 28. Here's Paul's conclusion. He says, "For we hold that one is justified by faith apart from works." Now here, James says, verse 24, "You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone." So which is it? The two contradict one another. The Bible contradicts itself. It's unreliable. Let's just throw the whole thing out, right? If it's off on this point, and this is a big point, then everything is unreliable. And here's how we understand this. Here's how this has been understood throughout the ages. James is not contradicting what Paul said. In fact, he's harmonizing what Paul said. Paul is addressing a group of people that are keeping spiritual score with one another. Right? They're trying to prove why they are better at the faith than the people around them. That's the issue that Paul is addressing. Comparing ways they measure up to God against everyone around them. Right? And here's the problem with that. You can always, always find some schlub that is lower on the spiritual scale than you are. You can always do that. What you need to do is compare your faithfulness to the faithfulness of Jesus and then see how that plays out. And that's what Paul is doing. He's saying, compare your faithfulness to Jesus. You're not going to measure up, but he will help you. He is the one that measures up for you. That's where Paul is coming from. He draws the conclusion that our good works are measured against Jesus. James, on the other hand, is addressing those who are looking for an easy way out. He's not looking at a group of people that are keeping spiritual score. He's looking at a group of people that are struggling, and they're asking the question, do I even really want to do this anymore? Is this a life worth following? Right? The Romans were all about, this is the only way to live. You've got to do it like me. The Jews that are scattered here that James is addressing, they're saying, I'm not sure this is the best way to do it. And so he's addressing those who are looking for the easy way out. He draws the conclusion that we're freed in order to do what we were created to do, right? And so contextually, Paul addresses justification before God. This is how you're justified in front of God, by your faith. James is saying this is how you're justified before men, right? He says, show me your faith. Well, who are you showing your faith to? Other men. And so James is addressing the issue of justification before men. Paul addresses the means, James addresses the outcome. How are we justified? We're justified by faith in Christ. What happens? You will do good works. That's the outflow. They shouldn't be separated. They are together. A saving faith is one that does something. Faith is the body, works is the spirit. Works are what animate the faith. So in summary, here's what I would say. Faith without works is a dead faith. That's the point that James is making through this whole text. It's a body with no spirit. Right? It's a body with no spirit. I know very much what that's like this week. One of the men that we work with in the Exodus program, about 3 weeks before I left for my Acts 29 Network retreat, he left the Exodus program. And I remember pleading with him, like, you're not ready, man. Let the men who you've submitted to, let them determine whether or not you're ready. And he left anyway. And on June 28th, just last week, he was found dead. Not sure what happened. I'm trying to be cautious about asking questions. So I went to his funeral on Friday, and it's terrible. But there it is. There's a body with no spirit. It's dead. It's not good for anything. Like, he can't bring joy to his family any longer. His hopes and his dreams. James is saying faith without works, it's like that. It's dead. It's over. Your faith isn't doing anything. It's not good for anything. It's not good for anybody. They have to be combined. Dead faith cannot save us. There is no such thing as living faith apart from expression in works that benefit others. And so, in essence, what James is saying is that there's what we do reveals who we are. It reveals whose we are. The truth of what we believe lies more by what a person does than what he says he believes. That's James' point. You can talk all day long, but if you don't have actions to back it up, if you can't show us the money, it's meaningless and it's dead. And here's the way it gets expressed. A false, dead, worthless faith is characterized in at least three ways. First way is empty confession, right? Empty confession. You say you believe God, demons believe, and they shudder. So let me ask you, your confession of faith, does it cause you to even shudder? Does the reality of what we confess to believe, does it affect you in any way, or is it just empty, meaningless words? For many of us, that's all it is, right? We play games, and we show up, and we put masks on. We pretend to be something that we're not. We say we believe certain things, but it's really just an empty confession. A life of deedless confession is empty and dead in faith. Now, some of us highlight our confession. And I don't want to castigate every Christian or every church out there. I just want us to ask, is this me? Am I the type of person that I highlight my confession independent of my action and sometimes use my confession as an excuse to not get my hands dirty? Are you that person? You say, well, Jesus justifies me. I don't have to do anything. Yet you have this mistaken notion that you're passive, that you're a passive recipient in God's kingdom. And while that is true about some things, it's not true about all things. God is looking to spread his kingdom through his people. This is not the God of deism that creates, spins the globe out there and says, hey, good luck. This is the God that's involved. How is he involved? He's involved through his people. He calls us his body. He says we are his hands and his feet, and he wants us to get active and not just have these empty conversions or confessions. The second thing after empty confession is false compassion. False compassion. You see this in the introductory question. What good is it if you see a brother or a sister poorly clothed, lacking in daily food? How do you feel about your brothers and sisters that are struggling to make it? Do you pretend to have compassion on them? Do you say you have compassion on them, but then you don't ever do anything about it? You say things like, hey, be warmed and filled. You dismiss yourself of the responsibility of taking care of your brothers and your sisters. The attitude of disregard for the welfare of those around you that God has providentially placed in your care so that you can be the channel of warming and filling is false compassion. If a brother or a sister that you see has need of food, clothing, and you say, hey, be warmed and filled, don't you think they'd look at you and say, man, if I could, I would be. If I could be warmed and filled, don't you think I wouldn't be asking for help? Yeah. And some people do. Some people ask for help, and they can probably take care of themselves. So James he's narrowing it down. He's saying brother or sister. He's not necessarily saying stranger and neighbor. He's saying brother and sister. For most of us, though, and I know this is true of myself, we're so preoccupied with our own stuff that we don't even have the eyes to see when a brother or a sister is in need. Because we're just investing in a rat race. We've made life so complex that we're not even looking. We're not even looking. We keep our eyes closed to our brothers and our sisters. We pop in here, we pop out of here, and we don't really listen for what's going on. We don't really look. Contrast this with the response of the early believers in Acts chapter 2. Look at what Acts chapter 2 says. They hear this good news, they believe it, and it says in verse 45, they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. Now, this isn't necessarily outside of the community. This is inside the community of faithfulness. But you've got people that are like, man, you need food, you need clothing. Guess what? I've got a boat. I'm going to sell my boat because I don't ever use it. I've got little kids that are actively involved in sports. And so my boat sits in my driveway on the weekends while you're struggling to eat. So I'm going to sell my boat and I'm going to give you what you need so that you can eat, right? That's what's happening with the people who are embracing it. That's the type of movement that began to change the world. Now, they weren't perfect, or else poverty would be completely eliminated, right? And it's not. And Jesus said, the poor you will always have among you. But there's a taste of the kingdom that you miss out on when your eyes are closed. There's this faith that you say you have that James is saying, I'm not really sure you have it. I'm not sure anything's really going on. That's a false compassion. And then finally, there's a shallow conviction, right? And so this is what happens when we recognize facts about God, right? The demons believe and shudder, but there's a disregard for his authority. I believe, I shudder, but I'm going to do what I want to do anyway, right? That's shallow conviction. Some of us highlight our works independent of our faith, like we really want to build ourselves up. Well, I'm doing a lot of good things, and you don't have any faith to match it, right? You think, I'll do these things, I'm performing well, this will get the big guy off my back for a while, right? And so I don't need to worry with all that faith stuff. Your convictions are shallow. And I think the reason that we do this, at least this is true in my own heart and life when it gets expressed, the reason I don't embrace things of the faith are because I recognize that when I do that, it causes Jesus to rule over every avenue. And many of us just don't trust him. We don't trust that he has our best interests at heart or in his mind or in his actions. We don't trust. And so our convictions, they stay very, very shallow, very shallow. And so I want to say this. We've got to become a people who do more than simply stop denying God. And that's step one. If you deny God, stop, right? But we've got to go beyond that. There are many who won't deny God, but they don't have living faith. Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, haunting words of Jesus. He says this, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, twice they call him Lord. Not everyone who says to me this will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. We've got to be a people who don't just say we believe, but we've got to be a people who demonstrate that we believe. And we have a great example, right? I mean, we have the best example. We have Jesus. When Jesus believed was expressed in every action that he expressed, every action, right? Jesus did not simply from heaven tell us things that were true about God. Even when he was in heaven, before he came in the flesh, you read through the Old Testament, and there's all these angels of the Lord. They're showing up. They're getting involved, right? You read the creation story. God doesn't just speak when he creates man. He actually plants a garden, and then he gathers up the dust, and his hands are getting dirty as he creates people. He's close, and he's involved. Everything that Jesus believed was expressed in action. He didn't just speak the truth from the distance of heaven. He broke in to give us what we needed most, which was freedom from our sin. Right? That's the thing you need most. More than food, more than clothing, you need forgiveness. And Jesus breaks in and he offers that, right? He lifted himself up on the cross, or was lifted up on the cross. He puts your sin to death. He buries it in a tomb, and then he rises above it. And then he doesn't stop there. He gives you more of what you need. He gives you God the Spirit. And where this empty confession of faith, this sort of faith without works, doesn't have the power to save you, God the Spirit living in you does, right? He is the power. He is the dunamis, the dynamite, that explosive power in you to give you what you need to express your faith actively. It costs us nothing to become a Christian, but it costs us everything to live as one. That's what James is saying. It doesn't cost you anything. You're passive in becoming a Christian. But if you are a Christian, if you belong to God, it costs you everything. It costs you everything. And I know we might have this tendency to try to make it easy for people. Like, I want to encourage you to walk out your faith with Jesus. I want to eliminate the roadblocks. But I'm afraid if we do that too often, we can excuse you from ever taking any responsibility for your faith and actually putting your hand to the plow and getting busy serving people. And so God the Spirit, he changes us. And he says, true believers will be active believers. So that's what we have to wrestle through this morning. Am I a true believer? And I'm not the one, I'm not going to cast judgment on you. I'm going to let the Spirit of God do a work in your heart. I want you to ask that question. Am I an active believer? If I'm not, I might not be a true believer. I might be confessing all kinds of right things, but I might not belong to God. I might not be one who's entering the kingdom of heaven. And I want nothing more than to see all of God's people in his eternal kingdom. I'd love to see everybody in this room in that eternal kingdom. And so I want to give you that chance to wrestle through it. True believers will be active believers. Here's what it will start to look like. And I'm going to give you some kind of foundational things and encourage you. You'll probably think of some more. I want to encourage you to process this in your community this week. Maybe you're in a city group. Bring it up there. Bring it up in at work, however you want to do it. But think through these things. Here's the big point I want to make. Living faith leads to life-giving action. That's what James is saying. Living faith leads to life-giving action. That's what we get from Jesus. So if we've got his Spirit, one of the things that we will do and one of the things that we need to embrace is that we can walk freely. We can walk in freedom. We can walk with a sense that even if we blow it, we're forgiven for that. And we are free from sin. We are free from death. We are free from condemnation. We're free from all those things. We're free in Jesus Christ to act on behalf of others. We're free from our own selfishness. We're free from our self-gain, our selfish ambition. We're freed from all those things to be about other people. And so we get to, in Christ and in faith, we get to walk freely. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, it talks all about this freedom, that you're saved by faith, apart from works, because it's Jesus that saves you. Why does he do it? Verse 10 says this, we are his workmanship. So Jesus is at work in us. We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for what? For good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Have you ever wondered, and I've wondered this a lot, if the ultimate point of life was to simply confess the truth that Jesus came up out of the grave, why is it that after the moment that you confess that, you're not radically whisked away to heaven? Do you know why? Because you're created to do good things. You're created to express the image of God. You're created to put his beauty on display. And all the things that kept you from doing that before, all the insecurities, hypocrisies, even as they creep up out of your heart, you have freedom over those things, and you have a power in you called the Spirit of the Living God that empowers you to express the truth and the beauty and the glory of God. So you can walk freely. Second thing, you can worship sacrificially. The story that he recounts about Abraham is all about sacrifice. What is Abraham willing to lay down? His son of promise. He had already believed in God. He had already been justified at this point. James marries those two ideas together in his book. But if you're ever going back and you're reading the Genesis account of Abraham and his son Isaac, he'd already believed. He'd already been counted righteous because he believed the promise of God. Now that promise he takes and he says, I'm going to lay that down. So he's going to worship sacrificially. He's going to say, God, you are worth everything that you've given me. And when you believe in Jesus, you will live that way. You will look at the things around you and say, this doesn't own me. God owns me. This career path doesn't own me. I can lay it down if I need to. This money, I can lay it down. So one of the things that we do at Missio in our time of response is we give you an opportunity to physically demonstrate something that God has always called his people to do, which is to give financially, to say, money does not rule over me. Jesus and the kingdom of God rule over me. And here's the beauty. Like, I've never had to do a series on giving. I probably should while giving is up and it's strong because you give so sacrificially. I love being part of a body of people that say, money does not rule me. and I will give very generously and very sacrificially. Right? So I should probably hit that sometime soon while giving is strong. So, because nobody ever wants to jump on a sinking ship, right? You're like, come on, guys, financially, the boat's going down. Who wants to jump on with me? Everybody's like, nah, we're jumping on this one. They're headed somewhere, right? So while we're headed somewhere, we want to say, hey, let's keep this thing strong and healthy. You guys are doing it. We are in just this weird season where typically we hit this slump in attendance and giving in the summer, and we're coasting right through that. We presented to our members the finances, how we're doing. We're spending well. You guys are giving well. I mean, things are financially very healthy because you give sacrificially. Now, I realize in saying that, I'm generalizing. Some of you are feeling that sting a little bit, like, man, I want to participate in that. And I'm going to say to you, yeah, you do. It's great. It's great. And I want to be careful. I say that. I don't want to say this as one who's boasting, but I'm one of the stronger givers in our congregation. I want to set that example. If you're a pastor or a leader in our church, like, we're looking, do you give? If not, you don't really believe this stuff. Right? Money rules you. And so we want to set that pattern. I'm going to leave that alone and continue on. Third thing we do, we want to commit fearlessly. Commit fearlessly. The example that he gives of Rahab, she is still called the prostitute, which I don't know if in the eternal kingdom we're going to call her that anymore. But what she does is she's a prostitute. She welcomes the people of God and then lets them sneak out the back door. Not because anything crazy was going on, but she was trying to protect them. She's trying to protect God's people. She's trying to keep them from harm. And so here's my question to us as a body of believers. As our culture continually grows aggressively against stances that the church for thousands of years has always stood on, and we start to bite and to devour one another, let me ask you, are you going to walk in the faith of committing to God's people, committing to protecting them, committed to not shaming them, to not exposing them, committed to keeping them safe, maybe sending them out the back door? That's what James says. We should be doing that. Do we cover for our brothers and sisters? Do we overlook? Are they perfect? Man, they're in here spying out the land so they can take over. That's not a perfect thing, but they're God's people accomplishing God's promises. And so we'll protect them. We'll cover them. We won't shame them. We won't expose them. Are you committed to that? Or are they going to make you look bad, and so you're going to shame them? You're going to expose them? And I think when we do that, we really just display what's really in our hearts, who we really belong to. It breaks my heart to see people that confess Jesus and then devour God's people. I will never understand, like, you could never have a strong relationship with me where you say, you know what, Kurt, I love you. You're my best friend. I love hanging out with you. I hate your wife. I hate your kids. No, man, they're such a part of me. I love them so much that if you don't like them, you don't really like me. We can't have that kind of relationship. And Jesus ties himself to his people so strong. He says, this is my bride. This is my body. So stop saying that you love him if you don't love him, if you don't love what he loves. Commit to God's people. And then finally, provide faithfully. Giving clothing provision, giving food provision. As needs arise, we shared with our members that we didn't have to give out as much of our benevolence fund this past term. And the reason for that is when needs arise in your missio communities, you guys are taking care of it. There aren't a lot of needs that are coming to the level of, hey, we can't take care of this. We need the church to step in. And I love that. That's the way it should be. As needs arise in your community, as people move into houses or move from one place to another, or need help making ends meet, I've watched you buy groceries for people. I've watched you give cars to people. I've watched you do amazing things where you're providing for the tangible needs of one another. That's evidence that we're a people that are trying to walk out this faith, right? We're meeting those needs, so keep it up. We're going to keep that benevolence line item. We want to evaluate how to do it even better, but we want to meet the needs of people. We want to meet the needs of people so that our faith isn't just empty words. I want to say to you, Missio Dei, I love you. Some of you, this may have felt heavy, but for many of you, you're just getting a shot in the arm, like, hey, we're doing it. And I want to say to you, keep it up. Keep going. Keep walking out this faith. Keep being active in it. It's so worth it. The sense of joy and satisfaction you get from walking this out, it is eternal. And it's life-giving, right? And so keep it up. We want to be a people who embrace both stout theological convictions and stout acts of service on behalf of those who don't know the truth about God. That's what we want to be. Let me pray, give you time to reflect and respond. Father, may the love of God that you have for us, the love that you have that it's expressed in Christ, that's poured out to us by the power of your Spirit, may it motivate us to have a living faith expressed in life-giving action for the glory of your name and the joy of your people. Amen.